Geekscape.com.
The Painted Savages of England by Reverend Alban Heath. When towards the end of August, 55 BC, Caesar and his legions landed on the shores of Kent, they saw the beach crowded with horses and chariots, and skin-clad, blue-dyed infantry, armed with pointless swords and uttering shouts of defiance, says Sanderson. Thus does the painted savage theory perpetuate itself. It is based on the description of Julius Caesar. Caesar was in Gaul. Finding a little time hanging on his hands, he resolved to visit England. Having spent altogether 18 days beyond the Rhine, and thinking he had advanced far enough to serve both honour and interest, Caesar returned into Gaul and cut down the bridge. During the short part of summer which remained, Caesar resolved to proceed to Britain. He came with about 80 ships and 2 legions, but more ships and soldiers were in the offing. It was intended as a flying visit only, for they came without baggage. As the autumn equinox drew near, around September the 23rd, Caesar was anxious to get away again and return to France under cover of night. It was too brief a visit to learn much, and his critics of a generation or so later seem to have made merry over his adventure. They said the visit tended to the advantage neither of the general nor of Rome, beyond the mere extension of the empire. It was said that he came to find pearls, but instead of pearls, he found painted savages. This was a short visit, and there was not time to learn much, but Caesar learned one or two things that apparently affected his plans for a second visit. The following year, Caesar came again. This time he brought with him 5 legions, or around 30,000 soldiers. If we accept Gibbon's findings on the strength of the legion, then 63,000 men, a number of horse equal in number to that which he had left on the continent, namely 2,000, and 800 ships. Things did not go well after landing. A fierce storm played havoc with his fleet. About 40 ships were lost, and most of the others were damaged. Under these circumstances, Caesar suspended military operations, set his soldiers to mend the boats, while he himself beguiled the weary hours of waiting by writing a description of the country that he had not seen, and in delineating the character of the men he came to conquer. He came, he saw, and he described. He wrote, "Most of the inland inhabitants do not sow corn, but live on milk and flesh, and are clad with skins. All the Britons, indeed, dye themselves with wood, which occasions a bluish colour, and have a more terrible appearance in fight." Of course, we are greatly indebted to Caesar for placing on record much that he wrote, but in utter disregard of an abundance of evidence to the contrary, writers of history have perpetuated the painted savage fallacy on such slender evidence as you have just heard. The evidence of one who had advanced no further than Kent, and had such little knowledge of the people whom he describes. A kind of conquest Caesar made here, but made not here his brag of came, and saw, and overcame. It is my purpose to lay before you some of the evidence which shows that the painted savage idea is not only a fallacy, it is a libel on a people boasting a high state of civilization and a proud degree of culture. Designedly, I give extracts from the works of others, so that my theme may not rest on personal conjecture. I begin with one of England's great lawgivers, Molmutius of the 5th century BC. I shall quote from Prehistoric London by E.O. Gordon, and I shall give the page references as I proceed. The earliest historical record of Winton, Winchester, as a Gore said, i.e. a great seat of a monarch and a seat of government, is in 500 BC, when, according to local tradition, Donald Marmutius made Winton his capital. Page 83. Marmutius' name and fame is more especially associated with the traditions of Winton, or Winchester, the southern capital, where his merits have been publicly recognised. As a roadmaker, we have his work in the seven converging roads, like the spokes of a wheel, in the old white city, three of these roads, centred in London. For that Londinium was only second in importance, is exemplified by Winton and London being the only places shown on an Anglo-Saxon map of the world, preserved among the muniments of Hereford Cathedral. The following selection from the Triads of Marmutius will give some idea of his laws. There are three tests of civil liberty, equality of rights, equality of taxation, freedom to come and go. There are three civil birthrights of every Briton, the right to go wherever he pleases, the right wherever he is to protection from his land and sovereign, and the right of equal privileges and equal restrictions. There are three sacred things by which the conscience binds itself to truth, the name of God, the rod of him who offers up prayers to God, and the joined right hand. Three persons have a right to public maintenance, the old, the babe, and the foreigner, who cannot speak the British tongue. Page 144. The Brenguin, or the White Hill, or Mound, where the Tower of London now stands, in Caesar's time, we should remember, was still in its original condition, simply a green conical mound, with no building whatsoever upon it, consecrated to the service of the Most High, and venerated as the burial place of two of the most illustrious of our prehistoric British kings, Brutus, the reputed founder of London, and Marmutius, the Solon of Britain. From Barthas, being a collection of original documents illustrative of the theology, wisdom, and usages of the Bardo-Druidic system, published by the Welsh Manuscript Society in 1852, we now learn that the Druidic Gorsedd laws were incorporated by the British king Donal Marmutius, who lived in the 5th century BC, in his famous code. That's page 165. After research in the British Museum, Mr. Harrison Hill writes, "The laws of Dunvalo Marmutius, 16th king of the Britons, who reigned about 400 years before the birth of Christ, these were the first published laws in Britain, and together with those of Queen Mercia, were translated by Gildas into Latin." That's from Usher's Primord 126, quoted in Wharton's Law Lexicon, 1925. The same information, plus an important statement, appears in the Law Dictionary. These laws were famous in this land till the time of William the Conqueror. They were translated out of the British and into the Latin tongue. Spenser sang the praises of Marmutius, and Shakespeare puts into the mouths of Cymbeline these words. "Say then, to Caesar, our ancestor was that Marmutius, which ordained our laws, whose use the sword of Caesar hath too much mangled, whose repair and franchise shall, by the power we hold, be our good deed. Though Rome be therefore angry, Marmutius made our laws, who was the first of Britain, which did put his brows within a golden crown, and called himself a king." A system of jurisprudence implies a standard of education. Before a man can originate or codify a set of laws, he requires a degree of culture commensurate with the task he undertakes. Further, a degree of culture is implied among the governed. One of the problems which confronts us in the government of untutored natives is their lack of knowledge of the meaning of the law, which is designed for their good. Since Marmutius promulgated laws which survived for at least 1500 years, we are bound to infer a state of education far removed from the level of painted savages. Have we any evidence of such education? We certainly have. For untold and unknown centuries, the Druids had operated in this land, and our increasing knowledge of them bears witness to their culture. In describing the Druids of Gaul, a description which applies equally to the Druids in England, Caesar says, "The former Druids are engaged in things sacred, conduct the public and private sacrifices, and interpret all matters of religion. To these, a large number of the young men resort for the purpose of instruction, and they, the Druids, are in great honour among them, for they determine respecting almost all controversies, public and private, and if any crime has been perpetrated, if murder has been committed, if there be any dispute about an inheritance, if any about boundaries, these same persons decide it. The Druids do not go to war. They, scholars, are said there to learn by heart a great number of verses. Accordingly, some remain in the course of training 20 years, nor do they regard it lawful to commit these to writing." Turning from Caesar to a recent work on the subject, we find supporting evidence. Mr. Dudley Wright has produced a large and scholarly volume on Druidism, from which I shall now quote, giving the page references as I proceed. In Britain, the Druidical order is said to have numbered 31 seats of education, each being a city or a capital of a tribe. Page 5. Repentance and purification were regarded by the Druids as necessary duties. They observed one day in seven as peculiarly sanctified and made holy by the great Creator, and they were wont to dedicate 1/10 of all their substance to religious purposes. Page 55. They were monogamists and of the highest morality. 56. The period of novitiate and the character of the training of an aspirant to the Druidical priesthood lasted for 20 years. Page 60. 4 degrees were conferred during the long novitiate, the first being given after 3 years' study in the arts of poetry and music, if the candidate, by his capacity and diligence, merited the honour. The second was conferred after 6 years' further study, if merited, the third after a further 9 years' study, and the final degree, equal to a doctorate, was bestowed 2 years later on the completion of the 20 years' course. Page 66. Before an aspirant to the priesthood could attain to that exalted rank, he had to pass through the 2 preliminary and definite degrees of bard or ovate. Page 75. The first requisite for admission as a disciple was unimpeachable moral character, for it was indispensably necessary that the candidate, above all things, should be above any criticism as to character and conduct. Page 76. Afterwards, their calling came to be held in such high esteem that they were maintained at the expense of the state. Page 76. 9 years was generally sufficient for graduation as a bard, but his education was not considered complete for the purposes of this graduation until he had committed to memory 20,000 verses containing in allegorical language the tenets of the Druidical faith. Page 79. From the triads of Donal Molmud, who is said to have written about 400 years before the Christian era, we learn that there are 3 distinguished characters of the art of bardism. First, the chief bard, or the free privileged bard, who obtains his dignity and privilege through discipline under a master duly authorized, being a conventional bard. He must preserve every record of the arts and sciences, while he should continue in his office of bard, regularly inducted in dignity and privilege. He must also keep every record and memorial of the country and tribe, respecting marriage, pedigrees, arms, inheritances, and privilege of the country and tribe of the Cambrians. Thus, that we have abundant evidence to show that a high state of culture existed in this land centuries before Caesar dubbed the people as painted savages. Unfortunately, the Druids did not favour writing, and consequently their words have not come down to us, but we see in the amazing feats of memory a strong argument in favour of the truth of those traditions which have come down to us through the ages. If the Druids left no tombs of learning to show to posterity the nature and extent of their learning, they left a noble race of people whose courage in the face of difficulty, whose conduct in the presence of the foe, whose dignified bearing in the day of adversity is to their eternal honour, and bears witness to the quality of that instruction and training they had received at the hands of the Druids. Fortunately, most of the work of the Roman historian Tacitus has come down to us and bears witness to his own industry and to the immortal fame of those noble Britons who withstood the onslaughts of the Roman legions. Tacitus flourished 55 to 120 AD, so that he was not far removed in time from the events he so graphically describes in his pages. First, let us take his account of the epic struggle Caradoc, or Caractacus, to give him his Roman name, and the Roman legions between AD 49 and AD 54. Tacitus writes, "These arrangements settled, Ostorius marched against the Silures. To their natural ferocity, that people added the courage which they now derive from the presence of Caractacus, renowned for his valour and for various turns of good and evil fortune. That heroic chief had spread his fame through the island. His knowledge of the country and his skill in all the wiles and stratagems of savage warfare gave him many advantages, but he could not hope, with inferior numbers, to make a stand against a disciplined army. He therefore marched into the territory of the Orovicians, having there drawn to his standard all who considered peace with Rome as another name for slavery, he determined to try the issue of a battle. For this purpose, he chose a spot where the approach and the retreat were difficult to the enemy, and to himself every way advantageous. He took post in a situation defended by steep and craggy hills, in some places, where the mountains opened and the acclivity afforded an easy ascent, he fortified the spot with massy stones, heaped together in the form of a rampart. A river, with fords and shallows of uncertain depth, washed the extremity of the plain. On the outside of his fortifications, a vast body of troops showed themselves in force and in order of battle. The chieftains of various nations were busy in every quarter. They rushed along the ranks, they exhorted their men, they roused the timid, confirmed the brave, and by hopes, by promises, by every generous motive, inflamed the ardour of the troops. Caractacus was seen in every part of the field. He darted along the lines, he exclaimed aloud, 'This day, my fellow warriors, this very day, decides the fate of Britain. The era of liberty or eternal bondage begins from this hour. Remember your brave and warlike ancestors who met Julius Caesar in open combat and chased him from the coast of Britain. They were the men who freed their country from a foreign yoke, who delivered the land from taxations imposed at the will of a master, who banished from your sight the fasces and the Roman axes, and above all, who rescued your wives and daughters from violation.' The soldiers received his speech with shouts of applause. With a spirit of enthusiastic valour, each individual bound himself by the form of an oath peculiar to his nation, to brave every danger and to prefer death to slavery. The intrepid countenance of the Britons and the spirit that animated their whole army struck Ostorius with astonishment. He saw a river to be passed, a palisade to be forced, a steep hill to be surmounted, and the several posts defended by a prodigious multitude. The soldiers, notwithstanding, burned with impatience for the onset. 'All things give way to valour,' was the general cry. The tribunes and other officers seconded the ardour of the men. Astorius reconnoitred the ground, and having marked where the defiles were impenetrable or easy of approach, gave the signal for the attack. The river was passed with little difficulty. The Romans advanced to the parapet. The struggle there was obstinate, and as long as it was fought with missive weapons, the Britons had the advantage. Astorius ordered his men to advance under a military shell and level the pile of stones that served as a fence to the enemy. A close engagement followed. The Britons abandoned their ranks and fled with precipitation to the ridge of the hills. The Romans pursued with eagerness. Not only the light troops, but even the legionary soldiers forced their way to the summit of the hills under a shower of darts. The Britons, having neither breastplates nor helmets, were not able to maintain the conflict. The legions, sword in hand, or with their javelins, bore down all before them. The auxiliaries, with their spears and sabres, made prodigious havoc. The victory was decisive. The wife and daughter of Caractacus were taken prisoner. His brother surrendered at discretion. Caractacus fled for protection to Cartis Mandua, queen of the Brigantes, but adversity has no friends. By that princess he was loaded with irons and delivered up to the conqueror. He had waged war with the Romans during the last 9 years, and his fame was not confined to his native island. It passed into the provinces and spread all over Italy. Curiosity was eager to behold the heroic chieftain who, for such a length of time, made headway against a great and powerful empire. Even at Rome, the name of Caractacus was in high celebrity. The emperor, willing to magnify the glory of the conquest, bestowed the praise on the valour of the vanquished king. He assembled the people to behold a spectacle worthy of their view. In the field, before the camp, the praetorian bands were drawn up under arms. The followers of the British chief walked in procession. The military accoutrements, the harness and rich collars, which he had gained in various battles, were displayed with pomp. The wife of Caractacus, his daughter and his brother, followed next. He himself closed the melancholy train. The rest of the prisoners, struck with terror, descended to mean and abject supplications. Caractacus alone was superior to misfortune. With a countenance still unaltered, not a symptom of fear appearing, no sorrow, no condescension, he behaved with dignity, even in ruin. Being placed before the tribunal, he delivered himself in the following manner. If, to the nobility of my birth and the splendour of exalted station, I had united the virtues of moderation, Rome had beheld me not in captivity, but a royal visitor and a friend. The alliance of a prince descended from an illustrious line of ancestors, a prince whose sway extended over many nations would not have been unworthy of your choice. A reverse of fortune is now the lot of Caractacus. The event to you is glorious, and to me humiliating. I had arms, men, and horses. I had wealth in abundance. Can you wonder that I was unwilling to lose them? The ambition of Rome aspires to universal dominion, and must mankind, by consequence, stretch their necks to the yoke? I stood at bay for years. Had I acted otherwise, where on your part had been the glory of conquest, and where on mine the honour of a brave resistance? I am now in your power. If you are bent on vengeance, execute your purpose. The bloody scene will soon be over, and the name of Caractacus will sink into oblivion. Preserve my life, and I shall be, to late posterity, a monument of Roman clemency. Claudius granted him a free pardon, and the same to his wife, his daughter, and his brother. Released from their fetters, they advanced to another tribunal near at hand, where Agrippina showed herself in state. They returned thanks to her and paid their veneration in the same style as they had before addressed to the emperor. The sight was altogether new. A woman, stationed amidst the ensigns and the armies of Rome, presented a spectacle unknown to the old republic, but in an empire acquired by the valour of her ancestors, Agrippina claimed an equal share. At the next meeting of the Senate, the victory over Caractacus was mentioned with the highest applause as an event no way inferior to what had been seen in ancient times when Publius Scipio brought Syphax in chains to Rome, when Lucius Paulus led Perses in captivity, and when other commanders exhibited to the Roman people kings and princes at their chariot wheels. Caradoc proved himself a foe worthy of the highly disciplined Romans. For 9 years he had defied them. In 39 battles they had failed to take him. Base treachery at last placed him within their power. His speech before the Roman tribunal was a noble deliverance which would do credit to the noblest in the land today. We have seen the spirit of the people of the West. We have seen the nobility of the man Caradoc. Now let us look at the quality and spirit of a noble woman, Boudica. The following incident took place, according to Tacitus, during the period AD 59 to 62. While the Britons were preparing to throw off the yoke, the statue of victory erected at Camulodunum fell from its base without any apparent cause and lay extended on the ground with its face averted, as if the goddess yielded to the enemies of Rome. Women, in restless ecstasy, rushed among the people and with frantic screams denounced impending ruin. In the council chamber of the Romans, hideous clamours were heard in a foreign accent, savage howlings filled the theatre, and near the mouth of the Thames, the image of a colony in ruins was seen in the transparent water. The sea was purpled with blood, and the tide of ebb, the figures of human bodies were traced in the sand. By these appearances, the Romans were sunk in despair, while the Britons anticipated a glorious victory. Suetonius, in the meantime, was detained in the Isle of Mona. In this alarming crisis, the veterans sent to Catus Decianus, the procurator of the province, for a reinforcement. 200 men, and those not completely armed, were all that the officer could spare. The colony had but a handful of soldiers. Their temple was strongly fortified, and there they hoped to make a stand, but even for the defence of that place, no measures were concerted. Secret enemies mixed in all their deliberations. No fosse was made, no palisade thrown up, nor were the women and such as were disabled by age or infirmity sent out of the garrison. Unguarded and unprepared, they were taken by surprise, and in the moment of profound peace, overpowered by the barbarians in one general assault, the colony was laid waste with fire and sword.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.